Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, and Justice Jacob. My name is Philip Renzulli. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Herbert M. Teague, and this is an appeal from an order in the Superior Court entered by Judge Tolliver back in, I believe it was May 18th, 2007, which granted the appellee's motion for judgment of acquittal under Rule 50, as well as an appeal by the court's ruling on August 14, 2007, denying our motion for a new trial and re-argument. Now, as way of background, this was a medical negligence case that arose out of a treatment that occurred on March 28, 2003, when the decedent, Gloria M. Teague, appeared at the office of Dr. E.C. Ocha, who was a defendant in this matter at trial on May 14, 2007. He was the only remaining defendant. The issues regarding that treatment was that the decedent appeared with symptoms of vomiting, diarrhea, and complaints of chest pain for about a week, and had a history of diabetes mellitus as well as hypertension.
And does the record show that he went to the emergency room 4 days before that?
That's correct. That was part of her history that she provided to Dr. E.C. Ocha on.
Did the doctor know that she'd been to the emergency room?
Doctor knew she was at the emergency room on March
24.
4 days earlier, that's correct.
So the choice when she presented herself 4 days later was send her to the emergency room again or send her to be admitted to the hospital?
That was a choice, and the issue with which we raised as part of our case in chief was that he elected to send her to the hospital to be admitted as a patient rather than have her sent to the emergency room, where she would have been given immediate testing and monitoring to determine whether she was suffering from coronary artery disease. The delay in treatment was significant. She was finally admitted into a bed at around 4 o'clock, and it was around that time that tests were conducted, but the results didn't come back for the following day. But that's pointless because she was found dead in her bed at 6 o'clock, 2 hours after she was admitted into bed.
Before we get into the rest of the day, remind me how it happened she went to the emergency room. That was her decision or a physician's decision 4 days earlier for her to go to the emergency room?
That was her decision, her and her family's decision.
So the emergency room looked at her, discharged her. 4 days later, she shows up at the doctor with these symptoms that you're describing to us.
That's correct. There's some issue at trial whether she actually complained about chest pain. She was seen by a nurse before she saw Dr. E.C. Ocha, and it was written on the nurse's note that her chest hurt times 1 week. And Dr. E.C. Ocha's own type notes didn't mention that, just mentioned that she was suffering from dehydration, gastroenteritis. That was his diagnosis, and he chose to have her admitted rather than sent to the emergency room. Now, before trial,
Do we know whether his thinking was influenced by the fact he didn't want her sent home again, that if he just sent her to the emergency room and they said, well, we just saw you 4 days ago, that they would have sent her home once again, and so he wanted to skip that part of the process and admit her because he didn't want her sent home? I mean, my question is there anything in the record that reflects that thought process?
There isn't, but it should be noted that he did not request copies of the emergency room records. Now, if he did, that he would review that, and maybe that would have influenced his decision why he's admitting her to the hospital rather than the emergency room. All we know is he never sent those for
right, those. Right, but I just want to make sure I understand the undisputed facts. And the undisputed facts are she went to the emergency room on her own 4 days earlier. She was sent home, and he knew that.
Yes.
Then she presents with these symptoms And he said, okay, I'm admitting you. And I understand the contention is, and your expert's opinion was, when she presented herself with those symptoms, he should have sent her to the emergency room again, where the test would have been done immediately, and that by deciding to admit her, the tests were going to be done several hours later, which, according to you, were several hours too late.
That's correct.
The contention on appeal is that you had a medical expert that was ready, willing, and able to testify that the treating physician breached the standard of care, but was not allowed to testify because, or at least he testified on direct, but then wasn't allowed to repair what damage was done on cross on his theory that he gave, on the theory that he gave an answer that showed he was not an appropriate medical expert. Where are we on the actual appeal of the denial of your motion for a new trial and your motion for re-argument?
Well, it's essentially what the court just indicated. Basically, we presented an expert that was, we believe, was competent, who has never raised before trial any issue as to his competency to testify.
Now, he was an internist and or a cardiologist, correct?
Internist, and practiced internal medicine as well as cardiology. And he described being an internist as being a general practitioner. And then, and he described that portion of his practice, which was approximately 40% of his practice and 60% as a cardiologist. Now, we know that cardiologists see patients on referrals, but he sees other patients for a variety of ailments, and that was 40% of his practice as a general practitioner, an internist.
All right. Well, what did he say that got him in difficulty on his ability to speak to the standard of care for a family physician?
Well, it apparently was only raised during his direct and cross-examination. During his direct examination, there was no problem because since we presented his credentials, he testified on the record that what the nature of his practice was. I'm an internist who practices general medicine, and I'm a cardiologist. Plus, he described the percentage of his practice. Then, after describing all the facts regarding the relevant facts in this case, he finally gave an opinion as to the standard of care. Now,
going to the Chief Justice's question, where did he get in trouble? It's my understanding that in response to a question on cross, he said, I'm not here to testify about the standard of care for family practitioners generally. I'm here to tell you what a family practitioner should do when a patient appears with these symptoms.
He said that and cross.
And the Superior Court concluded,
yes,
if you're not generally familiar with family practice, you're not qualified to give an opinion on this specific area at issue in this case. Wasn't that the Superior Court's ruling?
I believe not quite, Your Honor, because where I differ is that what he specifically says, I'm here to respond to issues where a patient with risk factors for coronary artery disease presents themselves with chest pain for a week, not other issues of family care practice. So basically he's saying when a patient who's comes in with symptoms of dehydration and vomiting and diarrhea, how do you evaluate this patient? It's our position that he establishes qualifications to render that opinion based on the nature of his practice. Now, he's not there to deal with other issues of family care practice because, as he testified also, the difference between an internist and a family care practitioner is, of course, a family care practitioner deals with pediatrics as well as gynecology, and an internist does not. Everything about an internist is in the same care practice.
Let me read his exact response, and you take the argument from there. I'm here as an expert on the treatment of patients with cardiovascular risk factors who present with chest pain, not any other emergency room issue or family practice issue. And I take it your argument really relies on that last phrase, not any other emergency room issue or family practice issue. So as that could be read, but evidently not as the Superior Court judge read it, He's saying if it involves cardiovascular risk factors that are evident from patients, even when presented to a family physician, I can talk about that and offer an opinion on that. But any other family practice issue or any emergency room issue is not within my area of expertise.
Well,
is that what you're contending that meant?
It meant that plus, but then again, if we're dealing with, he's competent to test if a patient presents themselves with, let's say, an issue of bronchiolitis for a family care practitioner, he's competent to testify about that because that's also within the practice of internal medicine. The only thing he's probably not competent to testify as to issues of family care practice is when they're dealing with pediatrics and gynecology, which has nothing to do with this case. He's competent as to other general practitioner issues.
Okay. Now, after your case closed, as I understand it, the defense moved for judgment as a matter of law.
That's correct. But
the trial judge didn't rule on it then. He allowed the defense to go forward and present its case, correct?
That's correct.
Then at the conclusion of all the evidence, he granted the motion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So the jury never heard it. The jury was not involved in any decision. The
jury was not involved. That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. Is there something you're contending that's wrong with the way the trial judge handled it?
Well, that's correct. We are contending because that ruling was incorrect and it was an abuse of discretion for a number of reasons. First of all, he relies on the defense's description that our witness was primarily a cardiologist. Therefore, as a cardiologist, he's not competent to render opinions as to family care issues. That's a gross simplification of his practice, which is clear on the record how he divides it. 40%, there's no finding of fact or law that 40% does not mean that you're not familiar with that kind of treatment of patients.
Okay, even if that's so, don't you have to make the point, don't you, that he also misreads Dr. Siegel's answer
to the
question on cross when he talks about not any other emergency room issue or family practice.
That's
part and parcel of it, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was argued during our, not only on May 18th when the issue was revisited after, but also on August 14th. That statement is ambiguous, then the court has a duty in order to determine whether he's competent to have this witness proper voir dire of this witness.
Now, what steps did you take to cure it?
Well, after we were actually surprised by this motion on May 16th, because we don't feel that the cross examination even was sufficient to give us notice of this issue. We attempted to contact Dr. Siegel, and of course, as most experts in these situations are, they're not available. They have a very tight schedule, and he was only available by phone on May 16th. Now, originally, I raised the issue, well, can we call him back for rebuttal? Or I was thinking out loud, maybe we should try to get him on video phone. At that point, when I was raising those issues, I had no knowledge as to Dr. Siegel's availability. After I left the court, I found out he's only available on phone on the 16th. We adjourned early on the 18th, which was a Friday. The jury went out early. The defense rested on the 18th around 9:45, and then that's when we revisited the motion. And counsel argued on that day, Matthew Osborne asked the court for voir dire, and the court denied it because he felt that the jury's entitled to see a reaction. An unusual response because I'm not familiar with any court in the Superior Court doing voir dire on the competency of expert in front of a jury. That's something that's normally done outside the hearing of the jury.
Well, that's probably because the jury had already heard the doctor testify and be cross-examined on his expertise. I mean, the typical voir dire takes place outside of the presence of the jury, but it also doesn't it typically occur that the credentials are challenged before the expert testifies at all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So could it be that the Superior Court judge's thinking here was the jury's already heard him testify on direct about his credentials and qualifications, heard him cross-examined on those same credentials and qualifications, so it would only be fair if I'm going to re-examine those for the jury to hear them and then reach my conclusion after both I and the jury have heard them?
Well,
I mean, I agree with you. In my experience, getting more and more limited by the day, this isn't a typical way of handling it, but is it an abuse of discretion to handle it this way?
Well, it's our position. It's probably an abuse of discretion at this point to even handle a motion at all, because we shouldn't have been even be put in that position where we have to bring back the expert by phone or return him, try to scramble to return the expert in order to clarify this issue. The defense had plenty of time. There's no issue that was raised during that motion that couldn't have been addressed prior to trial or when the witness was testifying.
Well, isn't Mr. Ferry about to tell us that it didn't come up until he testified the way he did? There was, and when it came up, what's he supposed to do? Not make an issue of it?
Well, how did it come up? He's basically saying that our expert is not competent to testify because he's not a family care practitioner. He knew that beforehand.
Well, no doubt, though, the other reading of the phrase that I read earlier, Mr. Ferry will read differently as Judge Tolliver did and say that that's the first time he said, either in responses to interrogatories about experts in any written report or in any deposition that may have been taken, the first time he's ever said that he's not there to testify as an expert on family practice or emergency room issues. Which is the other way of reading it. So,
well, it's got to be his exact words have to be used. I'm not here to testify as to other issues of family care. So,
okay. Did you want to save the balance of your time? You're into your rebuttal.
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Chief Justice Steele and Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Dennis Ferry on behalf of Dr. Isiocha. I did take the deposition of this expert beforehand, no issues were raised with regard to family practice at that point. So, I mean, I didn't. From what I hear Mr. Renzulli saying is that somehow I put him in a position where he was surprised or something by what had come out. But the way this happened was it came out through cross-examination, and it was a statement made by the expert himself that he was not there to testify about emergency room issues. And because he was the sole – he's the if I can start with a little bit about his background. His background
before
is...
Before you do that...
Sure.
Wasn't there in the pretrial discovery some disclosure, not only about what the doctor would testify about, but about the scope of the examination? That is, was there not disclosed in discovery the information that you say came out for the first time? On cross-examination?
No, Your Honor, there was not. I have the deposition here with me. Be glad to provide a copy. I looked through it last night in anticipation, perhaps, of this question.
Wasn't there an expert interrogatory answer that would have disclosed that information?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't think, you mean in terms of family practice?
Yeah, the exact limitation that you're arguing didn't come out until the middle of trial.
Well, that's correct. It didn't come out until the middle of trial because he was the sole expert in this case. There was another defendant in the case who was an emergency room expert, who was an emergency room physician, but defendant was dismissed. And the doctor here testified on emergency room. He testified on testified as to that doctor. He testified as to Dr. Isiocha. So he was testifying as to standard of care for emergency room, standard of care for family practice. And what I really think he was testifying to was what he would have done or what, in his mind, anybody should do. I don't think he had any distinction in his mind between emergency room, family practice, or internal medicine physician. He's just saying, and when you read that statement, I think that that supports my position in that he says, I'm here as an expert on the treatment of patients. with cardiovascular risk factors who present with chest pain, not any other emergency room issue or family practice issue. By lumping them together, he's suggesting that it's the same for everybody.
Well, let's look at a hypothetical, though. Isn't he basically saying, in a different context, if you're a doctor and someone walks into your office with a broken bone and the broken bone is protruding from your skin, you absolutely should send them to the emergency room. And so he was making an analogy. These symptoms are different, but they relate to the heart. And he's saying, if you have an office practice and your office practice entertains people that might have heart problems, it doesn't matter what the nature of your practice is, these symptoms required a referral to the emergency room.
Well, I think that's probably what he's saying. In his mind, every physician in the world, regardless of what you are, if somebody come in complaining of chest pain, you send them to the emergency room.
Well, we'll add in the other symptoms, but that goes back to my example of the broken bone. What would be wrong with someone saying, it doesn't matter what the nature of your practice is, if someone's got a broken bone protruding from their skin, everybody knows you send them to the emergency room.
Yeah, but that yours is a very simplified situation medically as opposed to a cardiac. This woman had been to the emergency room. They had worked her up for cardiac. They had given her the enzymes. They had given her the typical things that they do in the emergency room, and they came to the conclusion that the diagnosis was a viral problem. Now, Dr. Isiocha had never treated this woman before. She called on a Wednesday. She had been to the emergency room on a Monday, called on Wednesday, or the husband called, wanted to get an appointment for his wife. He had never treated her before, couldn't see her on Wednesday, said she can come in the morning. She came in the morning, he examined her, he admitted her to the hospital.
Let's move back to the issue on appeal and not whether there's a basis for him breaching the standard of care or not. Let's get back to how the expert was handled in this case.
Right.
On cross-examination, you discovered the rather significant statement that the plaintiff's sole medical expert declares that he's not an expert on emergency room issues or family practice issues. The plaintiff closes its case. You move for a judgment as a matter of law because it's clear to you the plaintiff doesn't have an expert. But you still go forward with your case because the judge reserves decision on that.
Right.
At the end of the case, the judge rules in your favor, and there's an attempt by plaintiff's counsel to get some amplification because he thinks it's a misstatement of some kind or a misreading of what his expert said. Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion not to allow the plaintiff's doctor to clarify that statement?
Well, I think, first of all, Your Honor, to answer that question, I did my cross-examination. Not only that one particular question and answer that we've been focusing on, but also in the appendix, if the court would care to take a look at appendix 30-31 to appellant's appendix, there's a number of questions and answers that I asked there about his knowledge of family practice, and he demonstrates there that he doesn't really have a knowledge of family practice.
Generally in Delaware, you know more about this than I do, but generally in Delaware, don't internists and family practitioners pretty much have the same practice? I mean, internists take on patients that could easily go to family practice.
They do, Your Honor, but there are differences in their training. The family practice is a much broader. As Mr. Renzulli was saying, they also take care of they also do some pediatrics. They also deliver babies on occasion. They do things like that.
Well, they have distinct board certifications, correct?
They have distinct board certifications. And in addition, you can't go from family practice track to cardiology. You must be an internist. They have different rotations in medical school. For example, the internist will do a lot more in the hospital work. And as I say, you have to go through that track before you can be a cardiologist. You can't go from the family practice track to be a cardiologist. So there are differences. The family practice is a much broader much broader in scope in the number of people that they treat. They also do some minor surgical procedures that internists generally won't do. So there is a very much a distinction between the two. They are very much separate. And I don't think it's just a matter of qualifications in this case. It's a matter of the plaintiff knowing that they have to go forward and that they have to, because of the medical malpractice statute, they have to, as part of the element of their case, present someone who has a foundation that they can, so that they can opine on whether or not a family practice doctor breached standard of care. He can't just get up there and say, without that foundation, oh, he breached standard of care.
Well, help me understand, Mr. Ferry, how this was not developed at the deposition. And the depositions are taken, but as you know, not filed with the court unless they're used for summary judgment or something else. You said right. You've reviewed it. It would seem that when you're deposing this person and you realize there wasn't a complete overlap between their expertise, what you would have been trying to ascertain at the deposition is he familiar with a family practice? And unless he could demonstrate familiarity at the deposition, you'd be moving to for summary judgment saying they don't have a qualified expert.
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, that's a matter of tactics. We're not required to take a deposition at all. We could go right into trial without a deposition.
No, I understand that. But my question is, you've read the deposition. We could get it since it's in the record. Just tell me why none of this came out, because part of Mr. Renzulli's argument in response to the Chief Justice's question about how we get to the issue on appeal is that there was a deposition, there was a pretrial stipulation, and we get to direct examination with the expert qualified in rendering an opinion. Mm-hmm. And he thought he had crossed the bridge on whether he had a qualified expert and was very surprised that your arguments didn't go to weight rather than dismissal of his case.
Well, Your Honor, it's not qualification. Every case, every typical type of cause of action has certain elements to it. And one of the elements is that he must lay a foundation that his expert is sufficiently trained in family practice in order to give opinions. I didn't ask questions about that. I don't recall right now whether it was because I just didn't ask it at that time. I might have assumed wrongly that Mr. Renzulli would have developed that on cross-examination. But I have an obligation as an advocate when it comes up and it appears for the first time to me that this person isn't qualified to render the opinion, then I have to do what I have to do on behalf of my client and ask for a judgment as a matter of law.
If the person has testified completely on direct before you get the cross-examination, the record would reflect that he's been qualified to render an opinion, and then he's rendered the opinion, and you would cross-examine him. I don't remember another case where a person's been qualified as an expert, permitted to render an opinion, and then on cross-examination it developed, well, I should have objected to your qualifications earlier, not let you render the opinion because you shouldn't have been allowed to do that in this case.
Well, Your Honor, but in this case it's unique in the sense that in response to one of my questions, I don't even know if it was a direct response, but he sort of got a little bit angry and said, look, I'm not here to testify about this. I'm here to testify about people who present with chest pain so he more or less kind of put aside the family practice emergency room and went right to cardiology as a general principle. So it happened in a unique fashion, but it is still part of not only qualifications, but it's also part of the plaintiff having to establish what the different elements of this particular cause of action, one being that they need an expert who is sufficiently trained. And it just came about that through that cross-examination and that he didn't was not focused in on his obligation to lay that foundation. I know my time's probably running out.
You have 7.5 minutes or as much time as we want you to take.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I do see that. I'm not running out as much as I thought. After I finished cross-examination, plaintiffs still had redirect. They could have gotten up and straightened out anything that they anticipated was a problem with an insufficient foundation. And I think they were certainly on notice by what I had raised earlier and on, and the doctor's response himself, to have said, okay, doctor, tell us about family practice and internal medicine and how it relates to one another. And do you have sufficient information and a sufficient basis to cross over and give us that opinion with regard to family practice? That wasn't done. And also, he could have, and I waited till I made my motion until the close of plaintiff's evidence, which is a typical time that you would make a motion like that. Plaintiff's counsel could have called my physician and, in addition to rehabilitating his own on redirect, could have called my physician and asked and tried to bridge the gap that way. He also...
Well, you would have objected to that, and there's case law that would support your objection.
Well, perhaps. Yeah. I mean...
I think you would have.
You mean him trying to use my...
Yeah, exactly.
Perhaps, although sometimes judges have gone different ways. It's not always the same. We have a little variation.
Well, let me ask you two questions about the point you're making so I completely understand it. First, was there a pretrial order that called upon the parties to object to their opposing expert witnesses by a certain date before trial?
No.
Okay. Disabused me of the concern that the only reason this issue came up, and you did cite appendix 30, page 31, appellant's appendix, was an ambiguous statement that not any other emergency room issue or family practice issue, because I still in my mind think that most internists dealing with the fact situation here would consider themselves capable of opining on what a family practice physician would do meeting those very same facts, because their practices are so similar. Now, disabuse me of the fact that you, and I don't criticize you for this at all. I understand exactly why you did it. If I were as smart as you in your circumstances, I would have done the same. But disabuse me that you didn't just seize on this arguably inadvertent addition to the statement, not any other emergency room issue or family practice issue, as if he was trying to divest himself of expertise in family practice.
Well, I think he was trying to divest himself of expertise in from taking it from the standpoint of the physician, which he needs to do. He needs to, again, establish that foundation that he has the knowledge in the same area as the defendant physician. Now, we know that they're separate. Can there be a crossover? There can, and this court has said there can be a crossover at times when a certain physician in one field, one discipline, can testify as to another. But the foundation has to be laid for that. The foundation wasn't laid. I cross-examined. Again, I mentioned to the court, on redirect, plaintiff had the opportunity to fix that and say, doctor, what is your background in family medicine?
It appears that in your cross-examination, we'll just assume you were asking him about, I know you didn't do this, I'm just suggesting to put his reaction in context. We talked about the breadth of a family practice. If you asked him about a woman who was 6 months pregnant, or you asked him about a six-year-old child, or you asked him about anything else that wasn't an adult with these symptoms, it seems that his frustration in answering was that he wasn't there to talk about six-year-old children or people who were pregnant. He was there to talk about what you should do when a person with these symptoms came. Isn't that another way to read the answer?
Well, I would disagree in that he throws emergency room in there too. So he's saying, I'm not here to talk about emergency room issues. I'm not here to talk about family practice issues. I'm here to talk about what you do when you see a person or a person comes to you with symptoms, complaints of chest pain. To me, he's tossing everything
out from the standpoint of the discipline, and he's going to, don't forget, his background is internal medicine, cardiology, and he has a PhD in electrophysiology, which is, of course, another aspect of cardiac care. And from this standpoint, to him, I think it's equally or even more of an argument that he's looking at this, that everybody should do what he does, and everybody should see this as through his eyes. And he can't, that's not the standard.
Mr.
The standard is family, he has to see it through the family practice physician.
Mr. Ferry, yes. To clarify one thing, was there a pretrial order entered in this case? Any pretrial
yes,
order?
Yes, there was.
All right. And I gather that the pretrial order did not contain any objection, at least from your side, regarding either of the experts that the plaintiff was going to tender, correct?
Either. There was only one, but
there
was no objection to
the qualifications
because I did not look into them at the deposition, which I believe is my right to either look into them or not look into them. It's plaintiff's obligation to know the elements of his case and to present the proper foundation to support each element. I feel like, you know, I'm saying like I did something wrong.
No, the only thing that would have triggered an obligation to delve into that at deposition would be a requirement under the pretrial order that if either side were to challenge the expertise or the testimony of the other's expert, they had to do so by a certain date before trial. A mechanism for avoiding surprises at trial when, for the first time, when a plaintiff's case hinges entirely on the testimony of an expert witness, they find out that there's a challenge or a defect in that expert witness's qualifications, whether on the face of them or from his testimony.
Right. There was no such order.
That's what I needed to know.
So I think plaintiff not only plaintiff had opportunity to cure the problem either through on redirect examination, but chose not to do that. Maybe they didn't appreciate it, but I mean that's the way it happened. It turned out that way, and
well, when I asked Mr. Renzulli that precise question, what did you do to cure it? He said, well, I attempted to get the doctor back in, and then the trial judge wouldn't let me because he was only available by telephone.
That's true. I mean, he did say, I want to have him come by telephone, and I objected. I said, no, I would not be comfortable with testimony by telephone from the physician at that point in time. I mean, I just think it's too... I don't know. It's not undesirable. Plus, I don't think our rules, permit it.
You can take a deposition by telephone.
You can, yeah. But trial, I mean, is a different matter,
This is an issue whether, as a matter of law, there was a foundation established. So, arguably, the jury didn't have to hear this testimony. That is, this testimony arguably would have been for the trial judge in either considering or reconsidering the motion for judgment as a matter of law.
I don't believe that would be correct, Your Honor, because the jury instruction that we give in medical malpractice explains to the jury that the testimony has to be by someone in the same or similar discipline, and the jury would need to have to be able to evaluate whether that person had the foundation.
So you agree that one way to cure this issue, that the problem from the plaintiff's standpoint, would have been for the trial judge to allow the plaintiff to take a short deposition, limited to the subject matter of this witness's expertise?
A short deposition?
Not whether by telephone or otherwise, but under oath, which would then be presented to the trial judge, as part of an expanded record to determine whether or not should be a judgment as a matter of law for the defendant.
All I could say, Your Honor, it would be highly irregular, And if you do that, you're going to allow for this type of application during trials as to cure all sorts of different things, and lawyers will be taken off the hook from their responsibility of proving their case during their case in chief. And there was really, plaintiff had the opportunity to fully do that and do that on redirect examination even after my cross-examination. I don't think this court
wants... Was the plaintiff know that there was a motion, that you were making this objection before he did his redirect?
Well, I hadn't made the motion at that time.
Nor
but
had
he
you
certainly,
made the objection.
He was certainly, he certainly
nor
should
Nor had
be.
You made the objection. That is, he would have had to have been clairvoyant, would he not?
No, Your Honor, not clairvoyant. He had to be familiar with medical malpractice, the elements of the cause of action of a medical malpractice case, which requires you, from the standpoint of the plaintiff, who has the burden of proof to prove each and every element, one of those elements being statutory. And if you're not conversant and familiar with the medical malpractice statute, you're liable to make mistakes like this or other mistakes. And, if it is a mistake, I don't know that it is a mistake, but.
Thank you, Mr. Perry.
Mr. Rizzoli, when the expert was testifying on direct, and does the record reflect the expert was asked, are you familiar with the standards for a family practice?
On direct?
Yes.
No, that was not asked. What was asked of him is his professional qualifications and for him to describe his practice, and then, which he describes as a general practice medicine, when he described the internal medicine portion, and then he was asked to render an opinion as the standard of care eventually down the line. Now, my understanding of the law on this issue is that even this is a case of the defense side, only a physician who administers the same kind of medical or surgical treatment about which he proposes to testify will be presumed to be competent. So at that point, since we established he practices general medicine, we presumed that he was competent to testify. Now, this was a rebuttable presumption, but we have to know about that they're rebutting this presumption, which they never raised.
But you have an internist cardiologist, slash cardiologist testifying in a matter involving the standard of care for a family practitioner. One would have suspected you would have said, notwithstanding the fact that you're an internist slash cardiologist, are you familiar with the standard of care for a family practitioner?
Again, that's a question. That if we presume he's competent to testify based on the nature of his practice.
Well, you're saying you assume that, and what Mr. Ferry's saying is that was an assumption that he eviscerated on cross-examination, and that was the end of your expert, and the judge properly excluded the expert.
Well, we disagree, Your Honor, because
no, I know that.
First of all, as to the position whether you eviscerated him, his cross-examination never established that internal medicine is in any way different from family care practice when it comes to evaluating these kinds of patients. Now, if he did that, then I would have gotten up and said, Mr.
Well, let me be fair with you. Based on what Justice Holland asked, it raises a question in my mind which you need to hear. What if you had asked him, are you familiar with the standard, because you practice in internal medicine and have in part a general practice, 40% or otherwise, are you familiar with the standard of care that applies to family practitioners? Would he have responded yes because our practices are so much alike, or would he have said, I'm not here as an expert on any family practice issue? What would have been his response? Since we seem to be here because it came up for the first time on cross. But had you asked him the question Justice Holland suggested, what would have his answer have been?
His response would have been, it's similar because we both see patients on a clinical basis. We treat patients in an office setting, in a clinical setting. We evaluate patients that come in a variety of ailments. That would have been his answer had this issue been brought up. Now, the thing is...
So he wouldn't have said yes. He would have given the answer you just gave.
That he's familiar with family care practitioners?
Would he have said, yes, of course I am. Internists and family practitioners in this area do exactly the same thing.
Sure, that's what he would have said. Now, the thing is, but if you read the defense's motion and objection, he's not even competent to make that answer.
Okay.
Because according to them, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Inslee. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.